Side 13. The Hidden City. The Tomilly, Book 3. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 444. Now, with all my heart, I would be Sparhawk again. To be loving Sparhawk, or even irritated Sparhawk, would please me far more than the dreadful emptiness which is Annika. There was a long pause. Know that I am well pleased with thee, my son. There was pride in the silent voice in Sparhawk's mind. I find more merit in thee in this moment than in any other. Be well, Sparhawk. And the voice was gone. The wedding ceremony was strange in some ways, and very familiar in others. The celebration of the love that existed between Venion and Sophronia was there, but the preaching that distinguished the Aline ritual was not. At the conclusion, Venetia gently laid her hands in loving benediction upon the heads of the two she had just joined. The gesture seemed to proclaim that the ceremony was at an end. But it was not. The second of the two figures that had accompanied Venetia across the luminous waters of the lake stepped forward, all glowing blue, to add its own benediction. It raised its hands over the man and the woman, and for a brief moment they shared its azure incandescence. And when the light faded, Sophronia had subtly changed. The cares and weariness which had marked her face in a dozen tiny ways were gone, and she appeared to be no older than Aline. The changes Bellion's glowing touch had wrought on Vanyan were more visible and pronounced. His shoulders, which had imperceptibly slumped over the years, were straight again. His face was unlined, and his silvery hair and beard were now the dark auburn Sparhawk dimly remembered from the days of his novitiate. It was Bellion's final gift, and nothing could have pleased Sparhawk more. Afriel clapped her hands together with a squeal of delight and flew into the arms of the nebulous, glowing figure that had just rejuvenated her sister and Vanyan. Sparhawk rather carefully concealed a smile. The child goddess had finally maneuvered Bellion into a position where she could unleash the devastating effects of her kisses upon it. The kisses could, of course, have been pure effusive gratitude, but they probably weren't. The wedding was at an end, but the glowing Delphae did not return to their empty city. Venetia placed one supporting arm around Anorai Sedan's frail old shoulders and guided him instead out onto the radiant surface of the lake, and the Shining One followed, raising a different hymn as incandescent Edamus hovered in the air above them. The light of the lake grew brighter and brighter, and the ethereal glow of the Delphae seemed to merge, and individual figures were no longer distinguishable. Then, like the point of a spear, Edamus streaked skyward, and all of his children streamed upward behind him. When Sparhawk and his friends had first come to Delphaeus, Anorai Sedan had told them that the Delphae journeyed toward the light, and that they would become the light, but that there were yet impediments. Bellion had evidently removed those barriers. The Delphae marked the starry sky like a comet as they rose together on the first step of their inconceivable journey. The pale, clear radiance of the lake was gone, but it was not dark. An azure spark hung over it as Bellion surveyed what it had wrought and found that it was good. Then it too rose from the earth to rejoin the eternal stars. They stayed that night in deserted Delphaeus, and Sparhawk awoke early as usual. He dressed himself quietly and left the simple bedroom and his tousled sleeping wife to go outside to check the weather. Flute joined him when he reached the city gate. "Why don't you put some shoes on?" he asked her, noting that her bare, grass-stained little feet were sunk in the snow. "What do I need with shoes, Father?" She held out her arms, and he picked her up. "It was quite a night, wasn't it?" he said, looking up at the cloudy sky. "Why did you do that, Sparhawk?" "Do what?" "You know what I mean. Do you realize what you could have done? You could have turned this world into a paradise, but you threw it all away."
"I don't think that would have been a good idea, Afriel. My idea of paradise would probably have been different from other people's."
He sniffed at the chill air.
I think we've got weather coming, he observed.
Don't change the subject. You had ultimate power. Why did you give it up?
He sighed. I didn't really like it all that much. There wasn't any effort involved in it. And when you get something without working for it, it doesn't really have any value. Besides, there are people who have claims on me.
What's that got to do with it?
What could I have done if Elana had decided that she wanted Archeum? Or if Dolmont had decided that he wanted to convert Styricum, or all of Tomoli? I have loyalties and obligations, Afriel, and sooner or later, I'd have made bad decisions because of them. Trust me, I made the right choice.
I think you're going to regret it.
I've regretted lots of things. You learn to live with it. Can you get us to Mithurian?
You could have done it yourself, you know.
Don't beat it into the ground, Afriel. If you don't want to, then we'll just plow our way through the snow. We've done it before.
You're hateful, Sparhawk. You know I won't let you do that.
Now, do you see what I mean about the power of loyalties and obligations?
Don't start lecturing me. I'm in no mood for it. Go wake up the others, and let's get started.
Whatever you say, Divine One.
They located the rather large communal kitchen in which the Delphi had prepared all their meals, and the storerooms where the food was kept. Despite their eons of enmity, the dietary prejudices of the Styrix and Delphi were remarkably similar. Cythrenia found the breakfast much to her liking, but Calton grumbled a great deal. He did eat 3 helpings, however.
"Whatever happened to friend Blockus?" Kring asked, pushing back his plate. "I just realized that I haven't seen him since the Lasta took fire."
"He went off with his guards, Domi," Finian replied. "He did what they sent him to do, and now he and the rest of the trolls are on their way back to Talesia. He wished us all good hunting. That's about as close as a troll can come to saying goodbye."
"It might sound a little strange," Kring admitted, "but I liked him."
"He's a good packmate," Ulof said. "He hunts well, and he's willing to share what he kills with the others in the pack."
"Oh, yes," Tinian agreed with a shudder. "If it wasn't a freshly killed dog, it was a haunch of raw seergai."
"It was what he had, Tinian," Ulof defended his shaggy friend, "and he was ready to share it. You can't ask more than that, can you?"
"Sir Ulof," Talon said, "I've just eaten. Do you suppose we could talk about something else?" They saddled their horses and rode out of Delphaeus. As he left, Khalad reined in, dismounted, and closed the gate. "Why did you do that?" Talon asked him. "The Delphi aren't coming back, you know."
"It's the proper thing to do," Khalad said as he remounted. "Leaving it open would have been disrespectful."
Since they all knew who she really was, Fleet made no attempt to conceal her tampering this time. The horses plodded along, as horses will if they aren't being pushed, but every few minutes the horizon flickered and changed. Once, somewhat east of Dirgis, Sparhawk rose in his stirrups to look to the rear. Their clearly visible trail stretched back to the middle of an open meadow where it stopped abruptly, almost as if the horses and riders had been dropped there out of the sky. They reached the now familiar hilltop overlooking fire-domed Mithurian and its harbor just as evening was approaching, and they rode down to the city gratefully. They had all been long on the road, and it was good to be home again. Sparhawk rather quickly amended that thought in his mind. Mithurian was not really home. Home was a dank, unlovely city on the Simura River half a world away. There were some startled looks at the gate of the Imperial compound, and some that were even more startled at the drawbridge to Elana's castle. Vanyan had stubbornly rejected his wife's urgings to conceal his head and face with the hood of his cloak, and quite literally flaunted the fact that 30-odd years had somehow fallen away. Vanyan was like that sometimes. There were some visible changes inside the castle as well. They found the Emperor in the blue-draped sitting room on the second floor, and, in addition to Baroness Meladir, Emban, and Oscania, 3 of his wives, Elisun, Gehenis, and Liatris, were also present. Elisun was probably the most notable, since she was now modestly dressed.
"Good God, Vanyan!"
and then exclaimed when he saw the Pandian preceptor.
What's happened to you?
I got married, Your Grace, Vanyan replied. He smoothed back his mahogany-colored hair. This was one of the wedding presents. Do you like it?
You look ridiculous. Oh, I wouldn't say that, Sophronia disagreed. I rather like it.
I gather that congratulations are in order, Sarabian said urbanely. There was a marked difference in the Tamil Emperor. He had a self-confidence and a commanding presence that had not been there before. Considering the enormous religious barriers, who performed the ceremony?
Vanisha did, Your Majesty, Vanyan replied. Delphaic doctrine didn't have any objections.
Sarabian looked around. Where is Vanisha? He asked. Sophronia pointed upward with one finger.
Out there, she replied rather sadly, with the rest of the Delphae.
What? The Emperor's expression was baffled.
Edamus took them, Sarabian, Flute explained. Evidently, he and Belium made some sort of arrangement.
She looked around.
Where's Danae? She's in her room, Divine One,
Baroness Melodir said.
She was a little tired, so she went to bed early.
I'd better go tell her that her mother's home, the child goddess said, going toward the door leading back into the rest of the apartment.
We've received any number of reports, Foreign Minister Oscania said, but they were all couched in generalities. The war's over and we won, that sort of thing. No offense intended, Queen Betwana. Your Etons are excellent messengers, but it's hard to get details out of them.
She shrugged.
Perhaps it's a racial flaw, Oscania, Excellency.
As she always did now, Betwana stood very close to the silent Engessa. She seemed reluctant to let him get very far away from her side.
The thing that puzzles me the most is the rather garbled message I got from my brother, Oscania confessed. Itania Ambassador has a great deal on his mind just now,
Betwana said blandly.
Oh? He and Etana Meris became quite friendly when he was posted to Sinestra last fall. He didn't take it too seriously, but she did. She came looking for him. She found him in Sirga and took him back with her to Sinestra.
Really? Oscania said, his face betraying no hint of a smile. Then he shrugged.
Oh, well, he added, it's time that Etania settled down anyway. As I recall, Etana Meris is a very vigorous young woman. Yes, Oscania Excellency, and very determined. I think your clever brother's days as a bachelor are numbered.
What a shame, Oscania sighed. Pardon me a moment. He went rather quickly into the next room, and they all heard the sounds of muffled laughter coming from there. And then Danae, her black hair flying, came running into the room to hurl herself into her mother's arms. Sarabian's face went bleak. Who finally killed Zelasta? He asked. He was at the bottom of all this, when you get right down to it.
Zelasta isn't dead,
Sophronia said sorrowfully, lifting Flute into her lap. He isn't? How did he manage to get away?
We let him go, Your Majesty, Ulath replied.
Are you mad? You know the kind of trouble he can stir up.
He won't be causing any more trouble, Your Majesty, Vanyan said, unless he happens to start a few grass fires.
He won't do that, Vanyan, Flute said. It's a spiritual fire, not a real one.
Will somebody please tell me what happened?
Sarabian said.
Zelasta showed up at Sophronia's wedding, Your Majesty, Ulaf told him. He tried to kill Vanyan, but Sparhawk stopped him. Then our friend here was just about to do something fairly permanent about Zelasta, but Quadge asserted a prior claim. Sparhawk considered the politics of the situation and agreed. Then Quadge set Zelasta on fire.
What a gruesome idea,
Sarabian shuddered. Then he looked at Sophronia.
I thought you said that he isn't dead. But Sir Ulaf just told me that he'd been burned to death.
No, Your Majesty, Ulaf corrected. I just said that Quadge set fire to him. The same thing happened to Baron Perak.
The trollish notion of justice sort of appeals to me,
Sarabian said with a bleak smile. How long will they burn?
Forever, Your Majesty,
Tinian replied somberly. The fire is eternal.
Good God!
It's further than I'd have gone, Sparhawk conceded. But as Olaf said, there were political considerations involved.
They talked until quite late, providing details of the campaign, the rescue of Aelana and Aelin, the freeing of Velium, and the final confrontation between Sparhawk and Sirgon. Sparhawk rather carefully stressed his surrogacy in that particular event, and made some issue of the fact that he was no longer Amica. He wanted that particular book permanently closed, with no doubts remaining in anyone's mind that there was absolutely no way to reopen it. Also, during the course of that long conversation, Sarabian told them of the attempt on his life by Chakol and Torelia. They might have actually pulled it off if it hadn't been for Elisun, he concluded, looking fondly at his now demure Valesian wife. Nirtai looked at Elisun with one questioningly raised eyebrow.
Why the change of costume? She asked bluntly.
Elisun shrugged.
I'm with child, she replied. I guess my days of adventuring are over.
She looked at Nirtai's puzzled expression.
It's a Valesian custom, she explained. We're allowed a certain amount of freedom until our first pregnancy. After that, we're supposed to behave ourselves.
She smiled.
I'd more or less exhausted the potentials of the Imperial compound anyway, she added. Now it's time to settle down and catch up on my sleep.
Has anybody heard from Stragan and Kaalador? Talon asked. Viscount Stragan and Duke Kaalador came back to Matherian a week ago, Sarabian replied.
New embellishments? Aelana asked with some surprise.
Rewards for services rendered, Aelana. Sarabian smiled. It seemed appropriate. Duke Kaalador has accepted a position in the Ministry of the Interior, so he's gone back to Libus to settle up his affairs there.
And Stragan? He's on his way to Astel, Your Majesty,
Baroness Melodir replied with a bleak smile.
He said that he wants to have a few words with Elrond.
Did Elrond manage to get out of Natios alive? Colton sounded surprised. Eclesius said that the Shining Ones had obliterated the place.
The word Kaalador picked up was that Elrond hid out somewhere while the Shining Ones were dissolving Scarpa and Sazada. Then, after they were gone, he crept out of the ruins and bolted for home. Stragan's going to look him up.
The Baroness looked at Khalad.
Krager got out as well, she told him. Kaalador found out that he was bound for Zenga in eastern Camoria. There's something you should know about Krager, though.
Oh?
Do you remember how King Worgen died?
His liver finally gave out on him, didn't it?
She nodded. The same thing's happening to Krager. Kaalador talked with a man named Orden in the town of Delo. Krager was completely out of his head when they put him on the ship bound for Zenga.
He's still alive, though, isn't he? Kaalad asked bleakly.
If you can call it that.
She sighed.
Let it go, Kaalad. He wouldn't even feel it if you ran your sword through him. He wouldn't know who you were or why you were killing him.
Thank you, Baroness, Kaalad said. But I think that when we get back to Eosia, Barret and I'll run on down to Zenga just to make sure. Krager's gotten away from us just a few too many times to take any chances. I want to see him in the ground. Can I come too? Talon asked eagerly. No, Kaalad replied. What do you mean, no? It's time for you to start your novitiate.
That can wait.
No, it can't. You're already a half a year late. If you don't start training now, you'll never become proficient.
Vanyan looked approvingly at Sparhawk's squire.
Don't forget what we talked about earlier, Sparhawk, he said, and pass my recommendation on to Dolmont. What's this?
Kaalad asked.
I'll tell you about it later, Sparhawk replied.
Oh, by the way, Aelana, Sarabian said, as long as the subjects come up anyway, would you be put out with me if I bestowed a title on your little songbird here?
He smiled fondly at Aelin.
I certainly hope not, dear heart, because I'm going to do it anyway. For outstanding service to the Empire, if nothing else.
What a splendid idea, Sarabian, Aelana exclaimed.
I can't really take much credit for the notion of the titles, I'm afraid, he admitted a bit ruefully. Actually, they were your daughter's idea. Her Royal Highness is a very strong-minded little girl.
Sparhawk glanced briefly at his daughter, and then at Flute. They wore identical expressions of smug self-satisfaction. Divine Afriel clearly would not let anything stand in the way of her matchmaking. Sparhawk smiled briefly, and then cleared his throat.
"Ah, Your Majesty," he said to the Emperor, "it's growing rather late, and we're all tired. I'd suggest that we continue this tomorrow."
"Of course, Prince Sparhawk," Sarabian agreed, rising to his feet.
"A word with you, Sparhawk," Patriarch Emban said, as the others started to file out.
"Of course."
They waited until they were alone in the room.
"What are we going to do about Vanyan and Sophronia?" Emban asked.
"I don't exactly follow you, Your Grace."
"This so-called marriage is going to put Golmont in a very difficult position, you know."
"It's not a so-called marriage, Emban," Sparhawk said firmly, cutting across the formalities.
"You know what I mean. The conservatives in the hierarchy will probably try to use it to weaken Sarathi's position."
"Why tell them, then? It's none of their business. A lot of things that our theology can't explain have happened here in Tamale, Your Grace. The Empire is outside the jurisdiction of our church. So why tell the hierarchy anything about them?"
"I can't just lie to them, Sparhawk."
"I didn't suggest that. Just don't talk about it."
"I have to report to Dolmont."
"That's all right. He's flexible."
Sparhawk considered it.
"That's probably your best course anyway. We'll take Dolmont off to one side and tell him about everything that's happened here. We'll let him decide how much to tell the hierarchy."
"You're putting an awful burden on him, Sparhawk."
Sparhawk shrugged.
"That's what he gets paid for, isn't it? Now, if you'll excuse me, Your Grace, there's a family reunion going on that I should probably attend."
There was a melancholy sense of endings for the next several weeks. They were all fully aware of the fact that once the weather broke, most of them would be leaving Mithyrian. The likelihood that they would ever gather again was very slight. They savored their moments together, and there were frequent private little interludes when two or perhaps three of them would gather in out-of-the-way places, ostensibly to talk at great length about inconsequential matters, but in fact to try to cement faces, the sounds of voices, and very personal connections forever in their memories. Sparhawk entered the sitting room one blustery morning to find Sarabian and Oscania with their heads together over a bound book of some kind. There was a certain outrage in their expressions.
"Trouble?" Sparhawk asked.
"Politics," Sarabian said sourly.
"That's always trouble."
"The Contemporary History Department at the university has just published their version of recent events, Prince Sparhawk," Oscania explained. "There's very little truth in it, particularly in light of the fact that Pandia Subot, our esteemed Prime Minister, turns out to be a hero."
"I should have deleted Subot as soon as I found out about his activities," Sarabian said moodily. "Who would be the best one to answer this trifle, Oscania?"
"My brother, Your Majesty," the Foreign Minister replied promptly. "He is a member of the faculty, and he has a certain reputation. Unfortunately, he's in Sinestra just now."
"Send for him, Oscania. Get him back here before contemporary history contaminates the thinking of a whole generation."
"Maris will want to come too, Your Majesty."
"Fine. Your brother's too clever by half. Let's keep Etana Maris nice and close to him. She might be able to teach him humility." "What are we going to do with the seer guy, Your Majesty?" Sparhawk asked. "Sophronia says that the curse that confined them was lifted when Sirgon died. And even though it's not actually their fault, there really isn't any place for them in the modern world."
"I've been brooding about that myself," the Emperor admitted. "I think we'll want to keep them away from normal human beings. There's an island about 500 leagues east of Tiga. It's fairly fertile, and it has a more or less acceptable climate. Since the Sirgai are so fond of isolation, it should turn the trick. How long do you think it might take them to invent boats?"
"Several thousand years, Your Majesty. The Sirgai aren't very creative."
Sarabian grinned at him.
"I'd say that's the perfect place, then."
Sparhawk grinned back.
"Sounds good to me," he agreed.
Spring came to Eastern Tamale in a rush that year. A sudden warm, wet wind blew in off the Tamil Sea, cutting the snow off the sides of nearby mountains in a single night. The streams ran bank full, of course, so it was still too early for travel. Sparhawk's impatience grew with each lingering day. It was not so much that he had anything pressing to attend to, but more that this prolonged farewell was extremely painful. There was one fairly extended argument. Elana insisted at first that they should all journey to Aton to celebrate the wedding of Mirtai and Kring.
"You're being ignorant again, Elana," Mirtai finally told her with characteristic bluntness. "You've seen weddings before, and you've got a kingdom to run. Go back to Simura where you belong."
"Don't you want me to be present?"
Elana's eyes filled with tears. Mirtai embraced her.
"You will be, Elana," she said. "You're in my heart forever now. Go back to Simura. I'll come by after Kring and I get settled in Pella, or wherever we decide to live."
Vanyan and Sophrenia decided to accompany Queen Betwana's party as far as Etana, and then to proceed on to Sarsos.
"It's probably the best place for us, dear one," Sophrenia told Sparhawk. "I have a certain status there, and I can shout down the fanatics who will try to object to the fact that Vanyan and I are married now."
"Well put," Sparhawk said.
Then he sighed.
"I'm going to miss you, little mother," he told her. "You and Vanyan won't ever be able to come back to Eosia, you know."
"Don't be absurd, Sparhawk," she laughed. "I've always gone any place I wanted to go, and I always will. There are ways I can disguise Vanyan's face, and mine, so we'll stop by from time to time. I want to keep an eye on your daughter, if nothing else."
Then she kissed him.
"Run along now, dear one. I have to go talk with Saravian about Betwana."
"Oh?"
"She's been muttering some nonsense about abdicating so that she can marry Angessa. The Aetons are subject to the Imperial Crown, so I have to persuade Saravian to keep her from doing something foolish. Angessa will make a very good co-ruler, and Saravian needs stability in Aeton."
As the spring runoff began to recede, and the soggy fields around the capital began to dry out, Sparhawk went down to the harbor looking for Captain Sorgai. There were less battered and more luxurious ships swinging at anchor in the crowded harbor, but Sparhawk trusted Sorgai, and a sail home with him would provide a comforting sense of continuity to the conclusion of this whole business. He found the curly-haired sea captain in a neat, well-lighted wharfside tavern that was quite obviously run by an Aleem proprietor.
"There'll be 13 of us, Captain," Sparhawk said, "and 7 horses." "We'll be a bit crowded, Master Clough," Sorgai replied, squinting at the ceiling. "But I think we can manage. Are you going to be covering the cost of the passage yourself?"
Sparhawk grinned. "The Emperor has graciously offered to defray the expense," he said. "He's a friend, so please don't bankrupt him." Sorgai grinned back.
"I wouldn't think of it, Master Clough."
He leaned back in his chair.
"It's been an interesting time, and the Tamil Empire is an interesting place, but it'll be good to get back home again."
"Yes," Sparhawk agreed. "Sometimes it seems that I've spent my whole life trying to get back home.
I'll reckon up the cost of the voyage and have my bosun bring it up to the Imperial compound to you. I almost lost him down in Baressa, you know."
"Your bosun?" Sorgai nodded.
"A couple of rascals waylaid him in an alleyway. He barely got out alive."
"Imagine that," Sparhawk said blandly. Evidently, Valish had tried to cut some corners on the hiring of assassins as well as on everything else.
"When exactly did you want to sail, Master Clough?"
"We haven't quite decided yet. Sometime in the next week or so. I'll let you know. Some of our friends are leaving to go overland to Aeton. It might be best if we sailed on the same day."
"Good idea," Sorgai approved. "It's always best not to drag out the farewells. Sailors have learned how to say goodbye in a hurry. When the time comes to leave, we always have to catch the tide, and it won't wait."
"Well put, Sorgai." Sparhawk smiled. Not surprisingly, it was Betwana who made the decision.
"We'll leave tomorrow," she
declared flatly at the dinner table a week later.
"So soon?"
Sarabian's voice sounded slightly stricken.
The streams are down, and the fields are dry, Saradian Emperor, she pointed out. Why should we linger?
Well, he let it trail off.
You're too sentimental, Saradian, she told him bluntly. You know that we're going to leave. Why prolong it? Come to Aton next fall, and we'll go boar hunting. You spend too much time penned up here in Mithyrian.
It's pretty hard for me to get away, he said dubiously. Somebody has to stay here and mind the store.
Let Oscania do it. He's honorable, so he won't steal too much. Your Majesty, Oscania protested.
She smiled at him.
I was only teasing you, Oscania, she told him. Friends can do that without giving offense.
There was little sleep for any of them that night. There was packing, of course, and a myriad of other preparations. But the bulk of the night was spent running up and down the hallways with urgent messages that were all basically the same. Promise that we'll keep in touch. And they all did promise, of course, and they all really meant it. The fading of that resolve would not begin for at least a year, or maybe even two. They gathered in the castle courtyard just as dawn was breaking over the Tamil Sea. There were all the customary kisses and embraces and gruff handshakes. It was finally Khalad, good, solid, dependable Khalad, who looked appraisingly at the eastern sky, cleared his throat, and said,
We'd better get started, Sparhawk. Sorgai'll charge you for an extra day if you make him miss the morning tide.
Right, Sparhawk agreed. He lifted Aelana up into the open carriage Sarabian had provided, and in which Emban, Talon, Aileen, and Melodir were already seated. Then he looked around and saw Danae and Flute speaking quietly together. Danae, he called his daughter, time to go. The crown princess of Alenia kissed the child goddess of Syricum one last time and obediently came across the courtyard to her father. Thanks for stopping by, Sparhawk, Sarabian said simply, holding out his hand. Sparhawk took the hand in his own. My pleasure, Sarabian, he replied. Then he swung himself up into Farron's saddle and led the way across the drawbridge and out onto the still shadowy lawn. It took perhaps a quarter of an hour to reach the harbor, and another half hour to load the horses in the forward hold. Sparhawk came back up on deck where the others waited and looked toward the east, where the sun had not yet risen. All ready, Master Clough? Sorgai called from the quarterdeck at the stern of his ship. That's it, Captain Sorgai, Sparhawk called back. We've done what we came to do. Let's go home. The self-important bosun strutted up and down the deck, unnecessarily supervising the casting off of all lines and the raising of the sails. The tide was moving quite rapidly, and there was a good following breeze. So our guy skillfully maneuvered his battered old ship out through the harbor to the open sea. Sparhawk lifted Danae in one arm and put the other about Aelana's shoulders, and they stood at the port rail, looking back at the city the Tamils called the center of the world. Sorgai swung his tiller over to take a southeasterly course around the peninsula, and just as the sails bellied out in the breeze, the sun slid above the eastern horizon. Mithyrian had been pale in the shadows of dawn, but as the sun rose, the opalescent domes took fire, and shimmering, rainbow-colored light played across the gleaming surfaces. Sparhawk and his wife and daughter stood at the rail, their eyes filled with the wonder of the glowing city that seemed somehow to be bidding them its own farewell and wishing them a safe voyage home. Here ends the tale of Sparhawk's adventures in the Tamil Empire. But further magic awaits. Follow David Eddings back to the world of the Belgariad and the Malorian. Follow him back to the very beginning for the story behind the legend of Belgarath the Sorcerer. End of The Hidden City, The Tamale, Book 3, by David Eddings. Read by Eric Sandvold in the studios of Talking Book Publishers, Incorporated, for the Library of Congress, February 1996.